Hey, good afternoon. I can't hear you. Can you speak up a little bit?
Shut up, Bill. You're joining We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan. I will be actually doing the Marge Simpson imitation today.
Yep, she's Marge today.
I could say I was Phyllis Diller, but people don't know who she is anymore. Someone said I sounded like Marlene Dietrich. I'm like, oh, that's even farther away.
I'd go for Ethel Merman.
No, that was when I was a kid.
Okay.
All right, so my snappy sidekick is...
Bill Cundiff.
And our sponsor...
I just wanted to hear you say it. Our sponsor this hour is Team Power. John Deere Kubota Tractor Dealer in Shasta Lake City. The folks up there will give you a great deal on a tractor. Service, parts, they got it all going on up there. They're at 3119 Twin View Boulevard. Or you can reach them at 226-9226 or get them on the web at readingtractors.com. They got an awesome website. Go check it out. You can get pricing, financing. Everything is right there. Just go check it out.
But just don't mow when it's really hot out.
Yeah, don't mow.
Please don't mow when it's hot out.
They're out of commission for at least a couple of months yet.
Unless you want to get up at the crack of dawn or you actually have a lawn.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't mow weeds and rocks.
Or you don't like your neighbor and you want to burn his house down, because that's what's going to happen.
But the way that always works is you burn your own house down.
Yeah, that's right.
So
who's our guest today?
And, you know, it kind of occurred to me, I kind of mention it, but I don't really say anything. You know, we have archives that go back to, like, 2010.
Yeah.
We've been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
And they are all, you can listen to them free of charge. You can download them. They're MP3 files. And all the commercial breaks are taken out, so that makes it a little faster to listen to.
That makes them commercial free.
They're like free and commercial free.
Oh, and more free.
Well, a lot of archive.
You're going to get sick of free. You're going to say, please stop making everything free.
Winning.
Yeah.
Well, the funny part is a lot of shows, I didn't know this, but I guess they charge for their archives. So apparently it's a potential fundraising opportunity that we're missing out on. But that's okay, because that's not why we're doing the show. Obviously, if you listen to the disclaimer, we're doing it just in case, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, we're probably going to say something bad.
Stay tuned. You can find all that at wethepeopleradio.us. That also has our contact information if you'd like to shoot guests our way, or you have ideas or whatever and you want to call or email. Phone numbers and emails are there for you. So,
there you are.
Swiftly, we're talking about immigration today. We have the 30,000-foot view with our guest Bruce Moran in the first hour, and then we will have an in-studio guest for the second hour, and he is a nice young man who came here on a student visa, whose visa is expiring, and he's actually going home.
Yeah.
Huh.
What's the matter with him?
I know. He's like the one and only. I thought we better interview him.
This kid doesn't get it.
He's a really nice young guy. I just thought people should hear his story, because he's a good kid. And he's really the kind of, you know, when people talk about immigration, this is the story that we want here.
It's also the story you never hear.
It is also the story that we don't hear. You're right. So. Mr. Moran has given us a tremendous amount of information today to cover. There's no possible way we'll cover it all unless he talks like grease lightning, and he is from Chicago, so
you can follow along on the website. The website has most of it on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
WeThePeopleRadio.us. So, Bruce Moran is a senior national security advisor who focuses on strategic planning for national security issues, and he is with Security Solutions Technologies. All right, Bruce. Take it away.
Yeah, what do you know about immigration, Bruce? Hello? Uh-oh.
Oh, Bruce is in the cone of silence.
Bruce? Uh-oh.
Bruce is never tongue-tied, so I know that didn't happen.
Did we dial the wrong shoe phone?
Hello?
Hey, there he is.
Oh, I've been here.
Oh, you must have been talking on the wrong shoe.
I said I'd be Johnny Carson for the fill-in, but I just didn't hear that one.
No, we didn't hear that one.
Or Carnick the Magnificent.
Yeah, we got a terrible connection,
there,
Bruce.
Yes, can you folks get back to me?
Yep.
Call me back, and then I'll pick up.
We will call you.
Yeah, that was.
That's why I wrote your number on this handy dandy post-it note.
Yeah, there was a reason for that. That was bad. That
it sounded like
it was Don Knotts. No,
it was like he was on a train track.
Yeah.
Oh, he was tied to the tracks.
Uh oh.
I'll save you.
I'll save you.
It's just sad.
It is.
So let's see. So I can tell you the rest of the stuff. Do the Muttley laugh. I'm going to be doing the Muttley laugh all day today. Don't make me do the Muttley cough.
Have another cigarette, Marge.
Good thing I never smoked. As a consultant, Bruce has worked with public officials, U.S. government committees, departments, agencies, think tanks, and corporations. He works on special national security projects and defines clear hands-on working solutions for crisis preparedness and crisis readiness scenarios.
There you go.
And now we're back to Bruce, who's maybe not tied to the train tracks anymore.
No, here we are.
Yeah, there you go. That's a little better.
Kind of tied to the train tracks, but...
A lot of better.
All right. Fire away.
Yeah, it's kind of disturbing the last couple of weeks with what we see going on in the media and constant high-pitched emotions that are going on with the border, the immigration, and with the children. So I wrote a few things. There was a Supreme Court ruling, as you know. And what I saw is probably the most important part of the Supreme Court ruling was that it designated foreign nationals to not have constitutional rights to entry.
Well, that's no...
That kind of sets the tone for the way the president can make his decision regarding how they're looking at people entering the country.
Well, do you think anybody was really surprised by that?
Before, he had selected countries that could not identify how the people were going to be vetted into the United States. So those countries are the one he had selected. And then, as you saw, it was Hawaii versus the United States it was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. So those kind of things are part and parcel to the big problems President Trump had faced when people were pushing back on him as obstructionists so he could execute his right as president. And one of the things I was looking at as you saw in the talking points, was foreign nationals and their ability to, you know, become United States citizens through asylum and to refugee status. And what I was looking at is how it's being done today and how Congress should act in order to be simply straightforward and to the point and making sure each and every one comes through an official port of entry.
And that's no different than it's ever been, but it just seems like in the last few years, all you hear about are the ones that come in illegally.
That's right.
And they still get...
But, I mean, it's the official so-called rule of law, but nobody's following it because as you look at Arizona, there's a 60-mile patch, Rio Grande, you have another area, California borders, you know. Everybody's coming across illegally. So when President Trump says you need to build a wall, you actually really do need to build a wall and proper fencing to and boating and, you know, guards and, you know, support to make sure that the criminal elements aren't coming through. And we have MS-13, as you know, he's cracked down on, and we also have the drug cartels that are infiltrating the refugees and the asylum seekers. So, you know, how we go about this should be pretty straightforward. If you are trying to circumvent or undermine or usurp the U.S. border security system, you're not going to get any asylum or refugee status. It should be straightforward that way.
Well, yeah, if you come in illegally, then you should forfeit your right to due process at that point. You're illegal. So,
that's right.
I mean, you got to come in through the port's entry.
Really addressed in such a straightforward manner. Because they're all here, and then they end up in a court system, and some are separated from their kids, some don't have kids, and then they have to come back within so many days. But how many actually do come back, you know? And that is the, you know, pivotal point in what President Trump is suggesting here.
But isn't...
We have to have a system that works, a system that's straightforward and transparent, and the people can't game. People know how to game the system before they get into the United States.
Well,
I'm not talking about just coming across the border illegal. They know what to do, how to get in, and then what to do once they're inside, how to game the system. So we have a problem in addressing the illegal aliens, or you want to call them immigrants. That's a problem in and of itself. And enforcement is one. As you look, you know, as we go further down,
but so take a really quick break, Bruce, and then
being harassed, intimidated, and it's not only them; it's been
hold on to that thought, and we've got to take a really quick break, and we are going to come right back with our guest, Bruce Moran. We're discussing immigration today, and you're listening to We the People Radio. Today. Just want you to know Bill didn't help me. He was supposed to, and
I'm
he didn't help
on
me.
That one. I had nothing to do with the music.
All right, so now that we have you in an unair-conditioned room, we're very sorry. But it's
I think what we're looking at is a new dawn of hyperbolic policymaking that's creating a lot of discord with people who belong to various parties, and as we're looking at what's happening with the immigration issue, that kind of situation is just way out of hand if they're intimidating border security personnel, agents. That kind of thing should be brought to American people's attention at every station and saying, these are the things you can do, and these are the things you cannot do. If somebody in Congress is starting to make incendiary remarks and people are taking and looking where these people live because they're all registered, you know, agents or people who work for Border Security or Secret Service or FBI, and they have a beef, a personal beef, it has nothing to do with the government worker themselves. The government worker is just doing their job. They have a beef with the government. And that kind of issue should not be taken up personally on people doing their jobs. This is ridiculous, and their families. Just think what a little kid would do. They're worried about the kids that are coming across the border, but every border security person comes from a family. They may have kids. You know, they have a mother and a father and kids. So how I feel personally about this, this is way out of hand and should be addressed.
Well, so the part that they seem to,
you know, taking sides, and the people in the government have to be protected.
Sure.
Some of them are my friends, as you know, and we work on national security. We're talking about across the board, foreign and domestic, and this is ridiculous.
No.
I just don't get it, how disrespectful people are now and how high-minded they are to think they could just go up to anybody and, irrespective of them being government agents, just rail on them. That's wrong. That's absolutely wrong.
No, it's everybody's doing it now. It's almost like it's a new game in town. Is find somebody that works for Border Patrol or FBI or even your congressional staffers are getting hassled
But it's interesting because I think that that Supreme Court ruling, you know, we don't want to gloss over this that just came out. And you had put a note in here, foreign nationals seeking admission have no constitutional right to entry.
Right.
I mean, these are not American citizens.
And how about if they're the ones who are doing the harassment, the intimidation?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's pretty bold. Yeah.
It's even way out of hand.
Yeah.
They think if they're doing something and they have a privilege, they're dead wrong. And I think it should start ticking Americans off that this kind of thing is happening in our own country, and it's getting to the point where we're losing control of respect and common civil understanding of how people should be treated on the street. I mean, or in a restaurant, or if you're going shopping, anywhere.
Right.
This is not proper and fitting at all. There's a certain disrespect and certain quality of life that has to be upheld. And that's what America's about. And that's the American dream. If they're trash dream for their own political ideology and they think it's going to be what they want and that way only, that's absolutely wrong. It's absolutely not right. They're infringing on other people's rights. They're discriminating against other people. Federal employees, you got to give me a break. You know, this is totally absurd and outrageous. So, I mean, that's where I stand on it, because those are also my friends. But, I mean, if you look at the way police have been treated, it's the same way.
Yeah.
And, you know, even now it's fire people. They may have programs on it. They're making them heroes. But on the street, you know, you go into the cities and they're being shot at. They're being discriminated against. You know, they can't get to their job sometimes. So
those
are the kind of things we need to really take a close look at in the civil understanding of how order needs to be made. Civil order has to be upheld and respected.
But you know, Bruce, it gets back. I mean, it goes back further than that. At least I believe when you allow illegals to have a driver's license, to register to college and get special rates, you make it okay to be here. Now you have given them rights.
Yeah, you've made it okay.
You've made it okay now for them to stand up and protest the inequality of them being here. I think that's where it all kind of started.
Yeah, when you can sneak into somebody's country and then demand they treat you better than their own citizens,
yeah,
that's pretty gutsy.
I mean, well, we allowed them to stay, though, and that's, I think, where the problem started was by allowing them to stay and then giving them status. Now you've got to address their grievances. You know, where does that stop? I mean, do you agree with me on that, Bruce?
I'm agreeing with you, and then I have to step back and say, why are they giving that platform in the first place?
Right.
Who is giving them that platform to do that? They're
Seeing
taking
waters.
A platform which shouldn't be there in the first place.
That's right.
They should be respectful. They should be dignified. And if they have something they want to address, go through the system, not go outside the system. And, I mean, they have a right to protest, right? I mean, that's everybody does. But they've gone over the rails, and they violated the right to be a citizen by coming here illegally. And then, for some outrageous, analogy they're using, that their rights are more important than American citizens' rights.
Right. But
that's where I don't get how they could have a platform and be legitimized by different groups. That's
well, do you think they have a right to protest when they aren't supposed to be here in the first place?
Well, they can protest, but that doesn't mean that they can force us to capitulate. I mean, that's really what the goal is. It's, we're going to create so much chaos, and we're going to unravel your stuff so bad that
right.
that you're going to just kowtow to us because we're obviously incredibly disruptive.
But see, the, thinking, that, wow, that voice, that their voice is heard, so it obviously has
That's
an
what I'm
impact.
Saying. They're given a voice and it's being heard,
right,
but it's not a legitimate voice in a way where they're using proper protocol and using the system itself to, because they usurped the system in the first place, and then they're gaming the system, and they want to game the system more.
Right.
So
you have a thing on here about improving the vetting.
What happened in Russia?
We'll talk about it later.
In the political bureau when they took over, you see what I mean?
Right.
That's what happened. You just have a louder voice, and everybody's gone. I mean, I'm not talking about Russia in particular. I'm not picking on Russia. They did it in China and Venezuela. And, you know, look what happened in Cuba. So, you know, you can go there and look at really nice cars that are in the 1950s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where I'd go for a classic.
You know, what's progress to them? You know, they come to this country and they're afforded all these basic necessities that they wouldn't have in their own country.
Right.
So giving, well, you're saying schooling and housing and... they're under a lot of our government programs.
Gosh, I'm so glad he mentioned the cars.
Yeah.
The vehicles. It's perfect. Gosh.
Yeah, I mean, 1950 cars, 60 cars in Cuba, we'd sell them here for, you know, $70,000,
$80,000. Oh, I know it. So,
I mean, I like to get a hold of a 57 Chevy, a 3-speed 327.
Yeah, that's been a taxi in Cuba for the last 25 years. Hey, we've got to take a break. And
yeah, let's talk about the issue a little bit more.
Yeah, let's talk about, let's hit on the, you had mentioned in your article here, better vetting. So when we come back,
it's a humanitarian crisis that people aren't really looking at it from this angle. And I don't see any of the networks really addressing this particular issue and how to really handle it. And be in a real common sense direction and making sure people are really protected. If people want families intact, don't use them as political pawns on one side of the aisle, you know. Use them as how you really want them treated and how they're going to get here in the first place.
Exactly. If people would like to see that plan, we have it all posted for you online. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
All my friends will a lowrider.
Talking about,
yeah, it's kind of funny. Yeah. I never thought about this song that way.
Huh?
But it seemed fitting. Okay, so now
here we are.
Yes,
and we're in El Salvador now, right?
Here we are.
We're in Guatemala and Honduras, and you're persecuted. You want to get out of there. You want to seek refugee status or asylum. And what do? Well, you take off
river?
And you make that big trek towards the United States, 1,000-mile trek. So that sounds pretty ominous, you know. And then if you're a young one, you know, you're a teenager, you want to get out, you go on your own sometimes. But what's your family going to say? What's your family? What are their responsibilities? You know, we got to think of a lot of things that are going on that are not just right, but there's a whole series of human rights violations and problems that exist, that these kids are being put out, and so are the women, and so are the families. So that's what everybody's protesting about. But what's a logical step and a practical step to take care of it? You know, that's something that has to be done through Mexico and through effort through the United Nations, and make sure that these areas, which we call failed states maybe, where there's terrorism or heavy, you know, transnational gang activity, it needs to be directly addressed. It's been going on for 20 years. And it's ridiculous as it seems, but the answer can be as simple as setting up a secure route for them to travel and register in the country so they can get through. And
right.
Then they could make sure that they know people are coming to the U.S. borders.
But they got to know prior. Excuse me. That part's great, but I think what you're saying is before they leave, they've got to make some kind of
plan
with the.
They have to pre-register with the U.S. consulate or the embassy.
Yeah, so that when you get to the border, they know you're coming, and you come in, and then you can go through the process.
That should but be like using an immigration system.
Yeah, you can't just mob the border and then...
But that's what they do, or they skip the border process and they sneak in.
Right.
So this is a way to have a uniform process with the Mexican government in order to substantiate a reasonable way to protect people so there's no human... rights violations or humanitarian crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the proper and fitting way to do this. I was sponsoring a soccer team. I don't know if you remember the big problems we're having in Ukraine. We're having an international soccer tournament in Chicago, so I went to Senator Kirk's office and I ended up talking to people in Ukraine about supporting the team to come over. So we had the team coach, team captains, and all the kids get together and file with the consulate and then the embassy to come over to the United States so they can participate
right.
in a soccer tournament.
And that's the right way to do it. That way, you know, everybody knows you're going to be here. Everybody knows who you are and what here for.
What you're here for, and you have the right documentation to bring with you.
Mm-hmm.
So my other point is those who are criminals will not want to enter that system. Because they need to know where they live, what they're doing, and what the reason is for coming here.
Right. Do you think that's something Mexico is receptive to as far as making that safe
that's
corridor?
That's something that should be done, as I was calling increased cooperation between the Mexican and U.S. authorities, so they can have a safe area of travel all the way through, from north to south.
Right.
Well, let's do it the other way, from south to north, because that's where from El Norte they call it. So, I'm beside myself because I grew up in the Mexican community in Chicago. Everybody's outraged, you know?
Right.
They're worried about the drug cartels in Mexico, the families here. The women are carrying around shotguns to protect themselves from the cartels. This is true.
Well, I noticed on the article you had there, one of the stats was 80% of the women and girls that travel on that route are raped.
Yeah,
that's unbelievable.
It's 2015.
Run it in line so we can make sure we cover all the points so the American public can know how there's a practical and sensible way to address this so President Trump can work with Mexico to make sure there's a safe route with checkpoints. Remember, it says checkpoints, and you can find out where they're at, how they're getting there, you know, if they're being undermined, usurped, you know, getting through the systems. The people have to be protected all the way through. Like I said, from the south all the way up to the north. And there's systems that can do it, you know. And today everybody has phones. You can call in stuff. You can we call it crowdsourcing, how we do national security. And that can all be put online for all these people who are coming through. If the media can cover it, and you can see them jumping on trains and people helping them, you know, and this can all be done in a proper and fitting way for safety and security. So we can call it a safety and security first initiative for the humanitarian crisis that's happening in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. And that could be done with the Mexican government. It's pretty straightforward, to the point, and the Congress should have been working on this, and if they don't, then I don't understand why they're not reaching out to Mexico, and, you know, the president can do that, too. He's just got elected. He's only been in, you know, a year and a half. So.
Right.
And they dumped this on his, lap. That's his problem. But it's been going on for 30 years. Porous borders, and Chuck and I worked on a secure, America's First Act of borders. But nothing substantive has been done for the enforcement side of it. So if we were talking earlier about enforcement, Chuck and I were looking at different things and how to do it. But the first thing is you got to make sure that people coming through who are seeking asylum and refugees are people who are going to come through the legal ports of entry. And that's when you put up the wall and say, here it is. Everybody else has come through the other way who need to be here illegally. It'll be all the criminals in these countries that want to come through. You know, they don't want to, you know, check in if they have a previous offense. People who are working for the cartels, you know, they're going to lap a couple kids onto them and say they're a family.
Right.
Been doing this for years. Now it's even more so because the way to make money has increased for the cartels. It's tens of billions of dollars for them. And, you know, it's over $100 billion a year. So, but I'm talking about in terms of what they can do, how they can do it, and how they get their drugs across. You know, so it doesn't matter to them. They'll just leave the kids on the side and get the drugs across, and then they're in. And where do those kids turn up? In our, you know, centers.
Right.
So there they are, and then they got to be, you know, taken care of. There's nothing wrong with that, but then the kids are off by themselves, and we're talking about teenagers and, you know, younger children.
So how, I guess...
You can see how insidious this is.
Absolutely, but how do you prove, when somebody comes across with a couple of kids from Honduras or someplace, you know, some...
Say they're from Honduras, first of all. All right, they might be the cartel.
Okay, so...
Or they can be criminals from the MS-13.
But how do you
bring in kids across?
But how do you prove that they're a family or prove they're not a family? I mean, they don't carry birth certificates.
Check them in their respective embassies and consulates in the country. That's one way to lessen that problem.
Right. But do they have any kind of paperwork to even prove who they are?
Yeah, they live in the country. They have, you know, same as we do.
Oh, okay.
I mean, they know where they live. We knew where all those kids were and who their homes were. They were living in Ukraine, you know, and the coach, you know, they make sure they got it, and then they walked into the embassy. All the kids came in together. You know?
Right. Well, I was just thinking on some of these.
Said, no, you go with the other person.
Some of these third world countries, you don't know where they were born or if they're born at home or if they're, you know. So I just didn't know if there was a way.
There's also criminal elements in these countries too, and they want to come in, so they can, you know, game the system and saying they're bringing their families. I'm talking about just the regular criminal elements.
Right.
And that's something that needs to be addressed because they probably won't go through the embassy, that's what I'm saying, or the consulate. So if we can narrow some of the ways where people are gaming the system, I'm not just talking to cartels, I'm talking about regular people in these countries and then other people who are criminals. And other people are related to, you know, other, you know, people want to get through. We just want to get out of the country, not legitimately, you know. there's a way to tailor it through a proper and fitting vetting process at our U.S. embassies and consulates. And then work with Mexico to have a safe route through where there's checkpoints. And you can make sure these people who have these papers through our embassy are being checked through entirely until they get to the U.S. border.
Yeah, I think that's a great plan. I mean, it's a heck of a lot better than what they got going on down there right now. I saw the other day where they were saying that Tijuana is just being overrun with tens of thousands of people trying to cross the border. And,
right.
you know, you think about that, and, I mean, where do these people, you know, where do you house them? Where do they, how do you feed them when you get that big of an onslaught of
well,
people?
Well, Tijuana is a big Sinaloa cartel stuff, you know, so
right.
they're just afraid.
But right.
That's the Mexican government's responsibility, too.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a human rights problem with the Mexican government.
Right.
Not taking care of their own people.
Right, yeah. I don't know how they can turn their back and how they can make that our responsibility when they're on that side of the border.
There you go.
So
that's one of the points. There's probably 32 of these points we can talk about on the radio, but I'm trying to keep it simple. You know, the cartels are causing much of the problem internally, causing people to become destitute, lose their farms, you know, things of that nature, or the restaurants, and then they gotta, you know, find other means and go to other parts of the state, you know, Michoacan or someplace, and try to make a living. So, like I'm saying, the women in some of these areas are protecting themselves with shotguns from the cartels. These are people who are normal people who want a normal lifestyle. So what we're talking about, there's a great turmoil taking place in Mexico itself that's out of control because of the cartel's influence and power and the huge amounts of money, you know, they have. So the Mexican government has to come to terms with that, and with the United Nations, they should come to terms with that, as well as we can work with them to make sure there's a safe route to help certain people that need to get through for refugee status and asylum.
Well, at the end of the day, everybody who's unhappy in their own country for whatever reason, they're not all going to be able to come here. I mean, we can't solve the world's problems by importing everyone who's not happy.
El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, and say, we're going to help out there. Make sure that people can stay in their own country.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Who's helping out Mexico?
Well, I think at this point, we sort of are in our own strange way.
Years, but, I mean, it's the drug cartels now that have, and arms running, they do both, and prostitution and things of that sort. But it's a larger problem that has grown in size and dollar volume. Years ago, it wasn't billions and billions of dollars. They were getting close to billions of dollars. Now we got tens of billions of dollars in cartels, and you add all the cartels up, you got hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, that's a lot of money to throw around and manipulate people around, you know, and
sure.
People coming through that are normal people with they might have a official status. They'll go with the cartel to make extra money to get on the other side, and they'll bring a cartel person with them.
Yeah, that's it.
You got to make sure at the starting point they don't get pulled into a cartel. I think the system can be made where that can prevent some of that from happening. You're not going to prevent all of it.
No.
There's going to be corruption all the time.
But it's incentivized at this point.
We're trying to mitigate, you know, the problems that exist. You're not going to eliminate it because
right. Everybody's
going to learn to game the systems, and that's just a normal course. There's a black market, right? There's underground economy, informal sectors. Lots of stuff is traveling with arms and drugs. But at least we could help people who want to live here and be part of the system and assimilate. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. I mean, there's a right way to do it, and it's really difficult.
There's an illegal, you know, black market way to do it.
Which right.
Yeah, right, which is a total mess.
Yeah.
When we have one more section of your outline to kind of cover here, and it looks like we might have run out of time, so we're going to come back with our guest, Bruce Moran, in just a couple of minutes. Need to celebrate a little capitalism for it. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Today.
I went for the theme.
Man.
See, we were talking about Mexico. I pulled all the right songs.
Looking for some Mexico songs. Yeah, that's great.
I was incentivizing you to help me next week.
Here, okay. And I'd like to take us into the violent acts against women and girls traveling to the United States via Mexico.
Sure.
That is one of the most outrageous things I've ever heard of. I mean, you know, I worked on the Assyrian Christian genocide, and this is kind of up there, getting close to that kind of a treatment of women and abuse. This was a 2015 figure. Before that, it was like 2013, 2014. It was 60%. It went up to 80% of the women traveling through Mexico. These are girls, too. The teenagers are raped. I think people should realize this.
That's unbelievable.
That is unfathomable.
Yeah, it is, totally.
And if we're looking at having a safe route, who are we going to protect if you have checkpoints to make sure these girls are still part of the traveling group, sure the women are still with them, going from the south to the north, El Norte. Make sure every person is not being taken off that route and use it by the cartels, used by people in the, you know, who are criminals in the areas. That is, to me, outrageous.
And again, it's going to be a terribly difficult task to achieve when you have that much money flying around down there to pay these people off to, you know,
keep just go steal them out of their traveling.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
When you hop on the train, you hop on with them and just push them off. You know, then you got, you know, here they're used, they're raped, they're sold as prostitutes, they're trafficked and used in sex rings. That's outrageous.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just as bad as the vulnerability of the kids. But nobody had really brought that up as an issue that's happening when you're coming from the South to the North to get into the United States. That is unbelievable. And the United Nations should deal with this as well. I mean, this is a human rights big issue. And it happens in the countries themselves. We're talking about El Salvador, you know, Guatemala and Honduras, but it's happening on the way through. So this kind of activity is just outrageous. And let's go to the last one. It's the children. The children are subject to the same thing. You know, pedophilia, all that. They're on the line. Some of them are coming across by themselves. So, and teenagers are traveling alone. What are we going to do?
Can't imagine sending your little kid.
How do we protect them?
There you go.
Exactly. How do you protect them?
There's the human rights part of the United Nations that's for protecting children and protecting young adults. But where are they now in terms of what's happening in this part of the world?
Well, don't they have to be invited into the country?
You hear mostly in Africa. You hear mostly in the Middle East.
Right.
But what's going on in Central America? What's going on in Mexico that nobody's paying attention to this? Why are they ignoring this issue? That's absurd.
So is that as far as the UN is concerned, can they, I mean, don't they have to be invited in by Mexico to help enforce the safety issue?
You have it in El Salvador. You have it in Honduras. You have the human rights violations going on there. They should be in there helping out. Full blast.
Yep. No, I agree.
That's why President Trump pulled his money from the UN for the Middle East, because they weren't supporting the Christians on the ground in Iraq, in the Nivea Plain region. I think he knew I worked on some of this, so I was beside myself since 2003, watching the persecution and the sidelining and strong-arming of Christians. In 2014, it happened to go into the genocide side of it, and where human rights were just tossed aside. And people are being crucified, roasted alive. Now look at the girls and the woman coming through from the Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador. They're facing the same kind of human rights violations. And it's just unfathomable. How come nobody's interceding here?
Well, and the one thing that we didn't get to particularly is, what about all the people who are not from South America? They're not from Mexico. They're not from South America. These are the
Middle Eastern.
These are the jihadi guys that are coming through that
That's
southern border.
Thing border security has to cover.
Yeah. So if we give preferential, I mean, the danger of preferential treatment to kids is that
since 9/11,
we're just going to talk at the same time. I'm just going to keep going.
Yeah. Can we back up for a second and talk about ICE relationships?
We need to get rid of ICE.
Yeah, I learned that yesterday.
Yeah. Well, don't throw ICE away, man. It's hot over here. 1995. We need it to cool off.
We need all the ice we can get.
Yeah,
ICE part is a definite law and order need, and President Trump's absolutely right. President Trump says, we're not going to discontinue ICE. And, Bill, can you go into that? Because, you can talk about the functions of ICE. I had written them out.
I don't have it right here in front of me, Bruce, but I just...
He's busy twirling his headphone cord.
No,
he got busted during his foot twirling.
I've just been following
green bulk gas smuggling, commercial fraud, intellectual property theft, cyber crimes, human rights violations.
Oh, yeah, read that list.
Human smuggling and trafficking, immigration, document and benefit fraud, narcotics and weapons smuggling and trafficking, transnational gang activity, export enforcement, and, of course, the international art and antiquity theft.
Well, and then I hear the other day they said if we get rid of ICE, then somebody else will step in and do what they're doing. We really don't need them. Well,
no, that's absolutely not
that's
the case.
Lunacy. I mean, without
the
these guys.
FBI is shorthanded. There's
sure.
only 15,000 of them. People think we got numerous people.
Yeah.
ATF is shorthanded. We have to add more ATF on, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. They got to be on the border, too, to help out.
Sure.
You know, DEA. I mean, we're a population of 320 million, and we haven't really increased the enforcement capacity of our, you know, departments and agencies. So those people, they in and of themselves are shorthanded. You know, I think we're calling for another 7,000 to 10,000 more on the border. There's not enough people there to do what we need to do to enforce the laws.
No.
And this is ridiculous.
Well, you can't get... Well, I think it was it the NSA that we had prior to ICE? They did that same job. So to get rid of ICE... I mean, what do they want to do? Just change the initials? Because somebody's going to have to step in and pick
personnel
up.
Personnel that know what they're doing.
And it'll be the same people.
The people.
Right.
The beef the people have, and it's legitimate beef that some of them are insensitive, but most of them are not, you know. And if somebody makes a mistake, you know, it looks bad on everybody. But 99% of the border security people are not doing that. And some of these people are causing hassles to make border security to be more aggressive. Then they say the border security people are too aggressive. No, the people are antagonizing, intimidating, and those people are doing that should be called on the rug. That's why we say the law has to be written that if people are intimidating, harassing border security personnel or any agent or their family, they can get jail time. If they know that, they're not going to do that, and then you can't play double jeopardy with the border security people.
No.
I don't like the double jeopardy situation they're placed in at all. It's not right. They're just trying to do their jobs, and then people are going to harass them at their homes?
Right. Well, it's definitely not right when you have members of Congress going out and citing these people to go out and confront... You know, public servants for doing their job.
I mean, we should really say it before we run out of time that at the core of the bulk of this is a deep desire to get rid of our borders. They don't want it reformed. They don't want different people monitoring it. It isn't that they don't like ICE. It really isn't any of that. They really just don't want borders. Because when you get right down to the crux of their argument, they just think that borders are a big pain. Anybody should be able to just waltz in whenever they want. I don't know how that works in their perfect world, but...
it doesn't work anywhere else in the world.
No,
it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
Well, so how can they...
That's why the argument is so illogical, and that's why we can't... That's why like A to B logic people can't wrap their mind around it. Hey,
you're
Bruce, we are flat out of time with you today. I cannot believe it. We blew an hour and... 60 minutes. Look at that.
When I saw we only had an hour with you, Bruce, it's like there's just no way we're going to cover what we want to cover in an hour.
We did fit in La Bamba, the Cisco Kid, and Cross the River.
God bless you guys. I want to say hello to the people in Ukraine. Yes, we did help bring the Ukrainian soccer team, where we're trying to get them over here. I think subsequent years they came over. So we have an international soccer tournament in Chicago, and they come from 20 to 28 different countries to play soccer here. So.
That's great.
And we're in the news.
That's great.
All right, you're listening to We the People. We're coming right
back.
Thanks,
Bruce.
Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Best part about the second hour is you get to hear the disclaimer again.
Yeah, and I am not responsible for what I say. I never have been.
I might not ever be responsible for anything again.
Uh-uh. Nope.
So you're listening to We the People. We are talking about immigration today, and if you missed the first hour, you can find it at wethepeopleradio.us. So my name is Aaron Ryan, a.k.a. Marge Simpson.
Yeah,
today.
Marge. Hi, Marge. And I'm Bill Kendiff.
And our Homer Simpson.
Bill will be cast in the role of Homer, yes.
Yeah,
excellent.
I'll be Homer. Right, yeah, and our sponsor this hour is Team Power, our local John Deere.
Has nothing
Kubota
to do with the Simpsons?
No, no. They haven't really had anything to do with the Simpsons for a long time. Anyway, local John Deere Kubota tractor dealer, parts sales service. Give you a great deal on a tractor right now. They've got great inventory sitting up there ready to go.
And a new sign.
Yeah, they got a brand new sign. Drive up by five, check out that new sign, day or night. Man, that thing is big. And you can find them at 3119 Twin View Boulevard up there in Shasta Lake City, or give them a call at 226-9226, or get them on the web at readingtractors.com. That's Team Power. And there you have it.
Ta-da!
Yeah.
So our guest today, this second hour, is a person in the studio, so we'll all be able to hear each other. And it's kind of bad that we won't be able to talk over him and like make commentary while he's still talking.
Oh, I'll talk over him. There's no problem there.
Yeah, it's going to make it hard. That's all over now. But our guest is Simon Watson.
A.K.A. Bart Simpson.
That's right. You could be Bart.
Yeah, you could be Bart.
The whole Simpson family.
I've really got to watch that show one day. I just really have never watched it.
You're missing out.
Apparently. Everyone says it's great. It's been on for what? 74 years or something?
Much longer than I've been alive, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Stop it.
I was born in 96, and it's been around since, I think, the late 80s or early 90s.
Wow.
Yeah, it has. Been around a long time.
We were out of college by then. Mm-hmm. And, we're old meets young. So, Simon is actually Australian.
Not a U.S. citizen.
Yes.
And you're
an Australian citizen.
You're here on a visa, right?
That's right. Despite not having much of an accent either.
Yeah.
Well, I know. Well, see, that's the thing.
I'm disappointed in that, by the way.
Yeah.
But I forgive you. What is the... tell me what the process is for getting a visa to come over here and work. What'd you have to go through to do that?
Well, I mean, the difficulty depends on the visa, but your typical visa, such as the one I came in on, which is an F1 visa, you use it to study at, say, college or university. The process usually starts online. You'll fill out a bunch of applications, pay a fee or two. It's a while ago, so I can't remember the exact steps. Yeah. But, you know, you pay a bunch of fees, you do a lengthy application online, you set up an in-person, face-to-face interview at the nearest U.S. consulate. So for me, that was in Melbourne, Australia. And then you go to the U.S. consulate, you wait in a waiting room for a couple hours, and you get called up to what looks like a bulletproof glass window, and they'll basically interrogate you for a little while. And their sole job, the immigration officer's job, is to you're essentially guilty until proven innocent. So you've got to essentially prove your innocence to them as to why you should...
That you're not nefarious and you're not going
exactly
to do something bad.
So, for example, one of those things would be, if you enter on a student visa, from the time that you get the visa, you're promising that you will return home after your studies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to try to ask you the kind of leading questions that will get you to, admit to that you're going to try to find some way to stay from the get-go. You know, you're going to try to get married, you're going to try to... you have some uncle over there whose mechanic shop you're going to work at, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they're going to try to, they're going to test you to see if what you're saying is really true.
And is this in the American embassy?
Embassy.
Okay.
Yeah.
All
so,
right.
You know, the U.S. has an embassy in the capital of basically every country around the world. And then, depending on the country, we'll have numerous what are called consulates in important cities in that country.
Is there like a lot of people lined up to get visas when you go in there, or is it not that crowded? Or
I'm sure it depends on the day. When I went there, the room was full of people. Some there probably getting student visas.
Right.
Some there business visas.
Yeah, because when I think of that, I think of our... you know, U.S.-Mexican border, and that's just got to be
how long
hell
do you have to sit on that wall?
Right.
I mean, it's just got to be a line around the building, you know?
Check your climbing skills.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's right.
So you pass that examination, and do they, stamp your passport and give you a visa at that point, or...?
Sort of. So they take your passport from you, and then they send it to their embassy, which is... because Canberra is the capital of Australia, so they'll mail your passport to Canberra, and where their U.S. embassy is, and then they will put a wax visa inside one of the empty pages on your passport.
Mm, okay. And how long is that good for?
It depends entirely on the visa. So my one is essentially good forever as long as you're enrolled in a educational institution, so a university or college, full-time. And the caveat to that is that you are not allowed to work full-time or at all off-campus. You can work on campus part-time.
Oh, so you have to be a full-time student and you cannot work.
Yes. So that's why, that's a big,
wow,
big caveat. Yeah.
And then when you're done with your studies, is there like a grace period, or do you just, when you're out of school, you're out of here?
Well, first of all, every time you complete a degree, depending on what kind of degree it was, you can work for a year or two full-time in the area of study that you majored in. So for me, that's politics, so that's why I worked for the Assemblyman for a year, salary paid, legally, obviously. But if you don't take advantage of that ability to work in your area of study, then you have a 60-day grace period to leave.
So you worked, and did you pay your taxes?
Absolutely, I did.
Okay.
Yep, both while I was working and before I was working. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that's kind of the basics.
What's kind of like start to finish? Like months? A year? I mean, how long from, like, I have this brainy idea that I think I'm going to go apply for this visa? I'm sure every country's different, but for your process, how long did that whole thing take?
So if you've got to combine the actual time it takes to do that visa process that I just explained, combined with researching, say, a university or college.
I was going to ask you that.
Contacting that university or college, building a relationship with their international student coordinator, filling out their application, getting accepted into their institution.
And does that have to be done before you do the visa? Do you have to show that you're into a school?
From memory, you do. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So I would say, it realistically, for someone overseas to say, hey, I want to study in the U.S., get my degree in the U.S., it's probably about a year-long process. I'm sure you can rush into it quicker than that, but it's a year-long process, I would say, doing all the research, the applications. And one of the big things that you have to do is you have to show that you're going to be able to financially support yourself. So both the U.S. government wants to see that, and the university wants to see that.
So you have to come here with, like, savings of some kind?
Yeah, because if you're not allowed to work while you're in school, you have to come over here with those funds.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you've nailed it on the head. So generally, ballpark, I would say they want to see at least twice as much as whatever the tuition is. So let's just say my associate's degree cost me $20,000, so they want to see that you have at least $40,000,
Wow.
Interesting.
Wow.
It's kind of funny. This is never the part we don't learn anything about this part.
No.
the people who actually do this correctly. Yeah, you guys are the unsung heroes of this whole process. When we come back, I want you to tell Bill how this all started for you. Because I think that part of the story, I knew you were leaving before I knew you were from Australia. So I kind of came at this all. I'm like, why is he going to Australia? That's he's really Australian. I'm like, what? What do you mean he's Australian? So I kind of backed into your story a little bit. So we should let people know, because it is a good story. And we'd like to keep you, so.
I'm humbled.
But we can't. Anyway, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And this country, it belongs to folks like me and you. So let the voice of freedom sing out through this land. This is our country. From the East Coast to the West Coast.
Everywhere around the world, they come to America. Every time that flag's unfurled, they come to America. Got a dream to take them there. They come to America. Got a dream they come to share. They come to America.
Yeah.
No.
I guess that's over.
You'll never get strangled. Yeah.
I've always said that these folks that have nothing good to say about our system, about our system of government and our country, need to go somewhere else. I don't care where. You can go to
pick a spot.
Take another Western nation someplace that is a democracy. and live there for a while and just see the difference.
Exactly.
Versus what we have here. And it's it'll blow your mind. It'll blow your mind.
So, Simon, when did you decide to come here? And why?
Well, you know, ever since I was a small child, I've had a profound love for this country. And, you know, when you're a small child, you don't really know why. You
like read about it in school or something?
Not a lot. I mean, we would probably learn a similar amount about the United States as you would learn about the United Kingdom, you know. So a fair bit, because you say, you know,
sure.
Go over topics like World War II or the English language. So obviously it's all tied together, you know. But not a huge amount, other than that, you know, countries like Australia are saturated in American pop culture, mm-hmm. whether it's music, Hollywood, you know, TV, movies, and just pop culture in general. But as far as school goes, it's not, you know, it's
so they don't really teach, and why would they, the whole American experience, the whole founding fathers, and how it all became free from England. And
no, I mean, so for example, when I was finishing high school, one of the history classes that you had to take was revolutions. So they would cover one of the great revolutions. It would be the American Revolution, the French Revolution,
right.
Russian Revolution. So there's a chance that you might be put in a class, you might select a class that's the American Revolution. But that's not everyone. Another person might just learn about the Russian Revolution. So
a lot of people over there don't really know a lot of American history. Why,
no.
I mean, I don't know any Australian history than used to be a penal colony. That's all I know. So how did you learn about...
That's going to hurt you on your visa application there, Bill.
Yeah, I know.
Just want you to know that.
They're going to use this against you.
I'm going to study up. Why do you know so much about prisons? What's the deal there?
What's up with that?
Yeah, what's that five-year gap in your work history?
Yeah. So what did you... What in your mind was the picture that was so, you know what I mean? What made it look like a good idea?
Attractive, to want to come here.
Well, I mean, I've always had an awareness of America's role on the global stage. And as I got older, I learned more about that. As I got older, I just started to read more books. I remember one of the first books that I ever read properly by myself and actually enjoyed it, and it wasn't torture to read it, was Ronald Reagan's autobiography.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yeah.
How old were you?
I think I was like 13 or 14. I used to hate reading
you
when I was a kid.
You are an exceptional young man.
It really started there. You know, I always knew I had that really interest and love for this country, but it's only when I started really learning more about it, about the history, of course, as you kind of touched on, mm-hmm. and the politics, the political system, how things were and how they got to be as they are today. And then the third part of that would be, you know, America's unique role on the world stage.
And was it always kind of the politics? I mean, was that intriguing even as a kid?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the politics was always intriguing. I would say I started off being more interested in you know, the international side of things. Mm-hmm. But then inevitably everything's connected. So you become interested in one thing, and then before you know it, you're really interested in another thing, you know?
Sure. Were you interested in politics? I don't know a lot about the politics of Australia or how it works exactly, but were you a follower of that? I mean, was it the concept of politics in general?
Yeah, I mean, I had a basic understanding. I'd watch the news, read the news, and whatnot, and have a basic understanding of what was going on. But my at least when I was younger, my interest definitely was across the Pacific Ocean.
Interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. What do you?
So, did your family think you were crazy?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Had to know.
What differences do you see living here and the culture here versus the culture in Australia? What really stands
actually,
out and makes a?
Yeah. When you came here, was it like you thought it would be?
So, you know, when I was getting ready to move over here,
yeah,
all my, you know, friends and family would say, you know, it's not going to be how you're expecting it to be. You've been too influenced by what you see on television and what you read. You know, it's not as idealistic as you think it is. And honestly, it is. It is. It really is.
It was exactly like you thought?
I feel vindicated. Yeah.
And they haven't been here, so you can tell them really whatever you want.
Yeah, exactly. And I've had the very fortunate opportunity to be more immersed in American culture and politics and the fabric of society than probably a lot of people who come here. especially if it's just for a few years, you know. Mm-hmm. So I've had a really unique.
Do you feel like you have more freedoms here than you have in Australia?
Without a doubt, and I think you asked.
And how so?
Well, I think first of all, it comes down to, you know, the founding of the United States. Mm-hmm. You know, where individual liberty was always a priority. You know, over other things such as, say, personal safety, or, you know, a smoothly running, very centralized government, or, you know, so it's always been a big pillar of American politics from the get go. And you were asking me a couple minutes ago, you know, what are some major differences, I think you said. And I think it would come down to one word, and that's individualism. You know, America and Australia are both capitalistic countries. They have a lot in common, and they both originate from England, right? So there's a lot in common.
Right.
But I would say the difference between the United States and any other country in the world, or at least the ones that I've been to or know anything about, is the amount of rugged individualism that Americans have. You know, Australia is a fairly free country. You know, if you go there, you're not going to probably notice anything that would really be like, oh wow, that's oppressive. But if you really read between the lines and really gain an understanding, America really is, despite what some people say, the freest country in the world.
Do you have the same freedoms there, like freedom of speech? Freedom to assemble, and
in practice we do, but it's not codified into the Constitution. It is,
which is a big difference.
It is a big difference,
yeah.
Because you don't have that solid foundation, so they can be withered away more mm-hmm. easily than here.
You had also said that that the United States was more conservative than a lot of other places, and
yeah.
I remember when you told me that, because I thought, all you ever hear now is that, you know, we're just some bastion of liberal insanity.
It's really not true. I mean,
I was like, yeah. need the guy from outside looking in, right?
It's really not true. If you go to any country in Western Europe or Australia or or New Zealand, or, you know, most places around the world, you'll see that you got to look at the political center. You know, I would say the political center is much more conservative across the United States than it is in a country like Australia. You know.
Okay, and so since you've been working in California state politics,
well,
do we make an exception for that, or?
Well, not really, because look at Northern California. Look how conservative,
right,
Northern California is. You know,
true.
And even if
you were in the good part of the state,
exactly,
you should point that out.
Right,
yeah.
Right. But even if you go to really liberal areas, you know, you'll talk to people that you'll think are really far left. But even when you compare them to people overseas, even though that their values are more left wing, they still have, you know, at least a trace of, you know, that American spirit in them. You know, and like, talk to people in Silicon Valley. Obviously, that's you know, a mm-hmm. more liberal area of the cultural of the country, but it has still that pursuit of you know, of
the American dream,
capitalism.
Yeah.
So it's if it's alive there, then you can bet it's alive everywhere else in the country.
You know? And you don't feel that or see that in Australia?
Oh, you do. I just say it's to a lesser extent.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And then obviously you don't have the Second Amendment rights that you have in Australia. That's totally different.
That's a big one. No Second Amendment. And Australia's had some of the world's most restrictive gun laws since 1996, when there was a very, you know, tragic mass shooting in the island of Tasmania.
Is that what set the whole thing off? Confiscation?
I'm not an expert on the history of gun control in Australia, but just broadly speaking, I'd say, you know, that there have been several mass casualty incidents throughout probably the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So I'm sure there were, you know, restrictions that came into place, and it got tighter and tighter. But without a doubt, 1996 was the turning point for gun control in Australia, because, you know, they had a mandatory national buyback program,
right,
where they essentially made it almost impossible to get semi-automatic weapons and pump-action shotguns, and those that had those weapons had to surrender them or face, you know, stiff penalties.
Are people mad about that there?
I would say a small minority of people are mad about it.
Really?
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It's just not Australia was a big hunting culture, but it's never been such a gun culture as it is here, you know, where it's more than just hunting. It's about a natural right. It's about self-defense,
right,
et cetera, right? It's never, I don't think it's ever really been like that in Australia. So it was easier to make the argument for gun control.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Easier in the larger cities, just like it would be here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Same.
Yeah.
Big urban centers.
Definitely.
And you grew up in Melbourne that has how many people?
I should Google on my phone. I think it's over 4 million, but okay, right.
Okay.
I don't know off the top of my head.
I mean,
it's a large city. It's like a flat version of San Francisco, you know?
Okay.
Think of that. I never lived in Melbourne. I always lived, you know, in the countryside, but with a close proximity to Melbourne. So most recent move was to an hour north of Melbourne, a place called the Maston Ranges. Really picturesque countryside area, but within an hour train ride or car ride to the city. So
interesting. Well, I want to know what you're going to do when you go back and that sort of thing when we return. We have to take a quick break. Our guest is Simon Watson. He is an Australian student who's been working in American politics, and his visa has expired. And
expiring,
wait for it.
Not expired yet.
terribly sorry. Yes, expiring. lest we meet the local ICE agent.
I know someone's knocking on the door out there.
I just heard the doorbell. And he's actually going to go back home, huh? Because his visa's expiring. Wow.
Well,
we could have you give lessons.
Novel concept.
Yeah. We hope you return, though. You're listening to We the People.
People talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me.
Don't stop believing. Hold on to that feeling. Street light people. Don't stop believing.
So you can go back and tell them it was all real.
Exactly. It was all real.
I think that's great. What was the first thing that you remember, like, that's exactly what I thought it was going to be like?
Just the friendliness and hospitality of the American people that I've met, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
And I think sometimes people feel like we're not doing that so well.
Yeah, people have just been so welcoming and inviting into their homes, and so willing to go out of their way to help me out, you know. So I'll always remember that. And I'm sure that, you know, there are great people in every country around the world and hospital people everywhere, but just that was one of the standouts.
But I mean, we're just noticed. You know, regular schlub Americans who live here, right?
Right.
So
right.
It's so interesting to hear, you know, somebody comes from a country that we would consider basically kind of the same, you come here and it's just fun to hear the viewpoint. And you didn't really know anybody when you came here. You knew a couple people or something?
Yeah, exactly. And then from those people, it branched out. So
yeah, because winding up in Redding, northern California.
Generally, you would think you would wind up in San Francisco.
What year did you come?
2015.
Okay.
So it's about 3 years to the date
that
I've been here. So I spent the first 2 years getting my associate's degree at Shasta College and, you know, putting my foot in the water, you know, on the political scene around and locally and around the state. And
Did you like help with campaigns and stuff?
I did, yeah. So so I actually, you know, I started going to Shasta College and then, as I said, started testing the waters politically and just seeing what I might want to do and learning about the area, and started interning for Assemblymember Brian Daly. And I interned for him for a year whilst I finished my degree. And then upon completing my degree, I, you know, worked for him as a salary staffer for a year. And here I am today.
Fast forward.
Yeah.
So how did you wind up doing that? How did you even really know you could go be an intern? Because I think there are a lot of people who've lived here a long time and have no clue.
It's funny because it kind of relates to you. I was at I decided to go to, I think it was the fall organizing the California Republican Convention near San Francisco.
Okay.
And then candidate Donald Trump was making a stop to give a speech at the convention near San Francisco. And there was mass protest.
And
we essentially got, there was a huge protest. We got basically locked inside the convention hotel that we were at. And it's, you know, I'm looking for something to eat. I leave the convention center and start walking down the street because they've got a pretty wide perimeter around it, so I could actually walk down the street before I met the protesters.
Oh, before you exited the
exactly, right.
safety zone.
So then, who comes driving by, I think in his BMW, or maybe it was Mercedes, Mark Spanagle.
Oh, that's funny.
So he sees me, and obviously he knows, because I've got my convention ID on, my Republican identification.
And did he know who you were?
No, he didn't know what I was. He just saw obviously I was a protester because I had my CAGOP thing on, right? And I think he rolled down his window and was like, hey, I'm going to go to a Chinese place around the block. You want to come? And I piled in the back of his car with a couple other people. And we went and had lunch and told him where I was from. And turned out that, his chief of staff for Congressman Doug LaMalfa, who represents District 1, for U.S. Congressional District. And that's the area that I'm living in, believe it or not. So
you just stepped right in the middle of it.
I know. That's a coincidence right there. And he started asking me, what I wanted to do. And said, definitely I'm trying to get as involved as possible, maybe do an internship or something, and ask him who would recommend. And I can't remember whether or not he recommended, your office, Congressman LaMalfa's office. He may have, but he definitely also did recommend Assemblymember Brian Daly. So that kind of stuck with me, and that's how that ended up happening.
What a crack up.
Yeah.
So you're just walking down the street.
Walking down the street,
Wow.
Still, right place at the right time.
So stuff
right there.
Totally works out for you. This is good. I can't wait to see what the rest of the story looks like. You'll have to
definitely. Yeah, we'll have to Skype in. Huh?
Yeah, I was going to say we want some reports back. So what are you going to do when you go home?
I'm going to try to
What were you doing before? I remember you told me. I think you worked at Starbucks.
I
wound up coming here. Right?
I moved here basically as soon as I finished high school. So I worked at Starbucks for 3 years when I was going to school. Saved up some of that money I saved up to come over here, but I'm definitely not trying to go back to the hospitality and retail sector. So,
why not?
Why not? Customer service is awesome.
So I'm going to, I'm going to try to continue open chapter two in my career as far as
you're going to try to get involved with Australian politics.
Yes. Yeah. So hopefully, find someone that
could go infect them with American ideas.
That's right. Find someone, similar to Assemblyman Brian Daly, someone who I at least, I want to work for someone over there where I at least agree with 80% of their political
views. I don't know how you could represent a member of any political body and not agree with what they think. I mean, it's not that kind of job.
I mean, that's what was wonderful about working for Assemblymember, Brian Daly, is that I truly believe in the political ideals that he believes in. I think that he's a legislator of integrity and has a great family and the best of all, great staff. So I want to find someone like that again. I don't have to agree with 100% of their ideals, but I want them to.
Yeah, but at least
want them to have integrity, and I want to believe with the majority of what they're. Just like you would, I imagine. Yeah. You wouldn't want to go work for Senator Dianne Feinstein.
Yeah, you're going to wake up in the morning and then find out they said what?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Because that blows back on you hard.
Yeah,
I mean, everybody's integrity is all tied together.
Definitely.
I always think of all those poor slobs who worked for Anthony Weiner. Imagine. Yeah. That's a bad day in the press right there.
Definitely.
Very interesting, though, that after this much time, because I've had a lot of people have called and said, they're panicked. Simon has to go back. We have to keep Simon. How can we keep Simon?
Unbelievable.
And so, your constituents are calling, how can we keep Simon? I know it's pretty cute.
I love that, and I love them.
They're like, we can't let him go. He's the kind we want to keep. They all say the same thing. The kind, right?
He's the kind we want to keep.
As opposed to the other fish we want to toss back, apparently. But the whole immigration thing, how hard would it be, just in what you've learned, to transition from coming here on a student visa? Let's say you did change your mind after you told the nice immigration man you were totally coming back. If you decided, hey, I'd like to stay here, is that even possible, or do you really have to go back and then do it again?
Probably have to go back and start all over.
Well, I mean, the U.S. has essentially a visa for every letter in the alphabet. So it's a huge system. And I'm not exaggerating there. So, there are a lot of different visas out there, but they all have different strict criteria, stipulations that have to apply to you. So generally, as far as someone like me goes, the main roadblocks are going to be lack of education and experience, education being the most important thing. So I've got a PhD, and I've got the State Assembly, for example, that somehow wants to sponsor me, and I'm a highly educated, well-accomplished person, then that's going to be a lot easier to find me a work visa that suits me rather than, oh,
his. So the work visa has to be in the field that you studied?
No, I mean, there are general work visas, is my understanding, but you have to tick a bunch of boxes. So, you know, they're looking at, you know.
Are you unique in your.
Right. Exactly. Do we need another worker
exactly,
in this field?
Right. So if you're a nuclear physicist, it's going to be a lot easier than some kid with an associate's degree in political science.
Right.
So, and that makes sense, right?
Because,
unless you're a liberal Democrat, then they're probably going to want to keep
you. And we have lots of those.
Yeah.
Interesting. So when you start looking at that, what are your avenues? Like, what are the choices going forward? You've been here once on a visa. Does that help you or hurt you if you wanted to come back again, or is it immaterial?
Well, I mean, it's immaterial for the most part. The good thing is that I 100% abided by all immigration.
Exactly. That weighs very heavily. So you actually went back
exactly,
when you're supposed to.
Exactly. And I never, you know, don't even have a speeding ticket to my name. So, you know, when I go back, let's just say I work for a decade or two in Australia and come back as an older man on, say, one of those work visas or maybe on a permanent residency card, then they'll look at my history and they'll see that there was no marks against my name.
No hanky-panky,
yeah.
Well, right. If your visa did expire,
yeah.
Right, not expiring as it is right now, mm-hmm. But okay, so the clock ticks, you've overstayed, then you what, hide out? I mean, how do people do that? They say that there's like millions of them that have expired visas.
Most people don't know this, but the majority, if not the vast majority, and I don't have any statistics, but at least the majority of illegal immigrants in the United States didn't come across the southern border. They just simply overstayed
their visa, yeah.
And
exactly.
That's like 60%. I mean, it's a huge percentage.
Exactly. So, you know, the thing is, America's got, a population of 320 million people, something like that. Got millions of immigrants. It's a huge country with a lot of other, you know, things going on, and it's nearly impossible to keep tabs on everyone that decides to
and they know
their
that.
Visa. And they know that. And someone who has no criminal record but decides to overstay their visa isn't exactly a priority for enforcement, as opposed to someone who's racked up multiple felonies.
But how do they get? How would you get a job if you don't have like a Social Security number, birth certificate, all that kind of stuff? I mean, the whole game changes after that.
You could forge your identity, so you could just buy a false identity.
Just stay here and be someone else, huh?
Right. That's the first thing you can do.
I didn't think of that.
But that's more difficult than, you know. I mean, I have a Social Security number, and
you do?
The reason I have one is because I pay taxes. So I worked on campus when I was doing my degree, because you can legally work part time on campus. So they. You know, it's kind of a, you know, catch 22. In order to employ me, they have to issue me a Social Security number. So even if I overstayed my visa, that Social Security number is still tied to my identity, and I could still, in theory, use that if I wanted to, and I may or may not get found out for doing so.
But then they could come snap you up.
Exactly.
Right. Or not,
yeah.
Wow. So overstaying the visa isn't really that simple, exactly.
It's not that simple, and, you know, if you're from a third world country that's war-torn and has a terrible economic situation, then you have maybe more incentive to overstay your visa because you're returning to a nightmare when you return home. So maybe you say, okay, it's worth the possibility of getting caught, it's worth having to look over my back to stay here, overstay it, because my life here is so much better than back home, you know. But for someone from a country like Australia to do that,
It's
kind of silly because once you overstay your visa, you can never go home to visit family because the way they figure it out, the way they track you is essentially not when so much when you depart the country, but when you arrive the country. They'll see you the last time you depart the country.
Yeah, we only keep track when people come back in.
Yeah, so if you overstay your visa,
you can never come back home, but
then when you pull your passport out to come back, they're going to go,
So that's the thing. And you can never come back, and... So either you can never leave, or you can never come back. So that's and you can never, you know, unless you've found some very unique situation, you can't have a professional job. You can have a job that pays good money, but you can never
back
have
to Starbucks again.
But you can never have a job that had a background check on it.
How's that work? Totally ignorant on this subject, but if I wanted to say I lived in Australia and I wanted to come over here and vacation, how long can I stay?
I believe you can stay up to 90 days. Although, don't quote me on it because I'm not an expert. But
there's
it's
no
about
visa. They don't issue a visa or anything when you come over.
Just travel.
So there are certain countries which are a part of the United States visa waiver program. And Australia is one of them. Most of the countries in Europe are also part of it. So you do not need a visa. You do not need a tourist visa. You just need to fill out an instant application online, print it out, and give it to the immigration officers when you're entering the port of entry, like right. LAX, and then you're in, because you're in that group of countries that I guess.
So I'm sure there's something in that verbiage that says you can stay for a certain amount of time.
Yeah, I imagine it's like 90 days or something right. like that, and you can't obviously work
right.
or anything. Like
and then
that.
Again, if you overstay that yeah, and try to come back, you're SOL.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a tricky place. One of the people that wanted the congressman to make a call for you, he said, can't he just call somebody? And I'm like, this isn't like the Wizard of Oz
Simon,
with the guy with
yeah,
the fuzzy
okay.
mittens at the door.
I mean, well, that's exactly right. I mean, America...
There's like no guy to call.
The United States is a country of laws, and it is not a corrupt country like, say, Russia, where...
There would be someone to call.
Yeah, in Russia, I'm sure if you know the right person that has the right Kremlin connection, then you get whatever visa under the sun, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
But America is not like that. It's a system of laws, and it does not have that kind of corruption where you just know the right person and you got the insider hookup.
Bring on the oligarchs.
And a lot of people would debate that, but that's the truth.
Yeah, when you try to work things like immigration, then you find out,
or many other things.
Yeah, it's not as easy to
call
the guy.
Tom Basengo doesn't mean you're just going to get let out of jail, right?
Yeah, so, yeah. Just call the sheriff. He'll just let you out.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I know him.
He disowned you, though?
Oh, it's his loss.
You got nothing for that? All right, we'll be right back with our guest, Simon Watson. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. There you go.
Sing it, Ray.
Figured that would be a good send-off song.
Your music selection's on point.
That would give you something to take home. all the versions. What's the national song in Australia?
It's the Australian national anthem. You just have to look it up. I'm not sure. It's not called...
You're not going to sing it for
it? I'm not going to sing it for you, no.
Well, I forgot to tell you about that.
You'll have to look it up on YouTube there.
But, I mean, is it like our national anthem?
Sure, yeah. It has similarities.
But, I mean, do you have to... You know, I mean, is it customary to stand up? I mean,
It's customary to stand up, but it's not customary to put your hand on your heart.
Do you guys have, like, a Pledge of Allegiance?
No.
Thing?
No, there's no Pledge of Allegiance that I'm aware of. There may be one, but nothing in common use.
Oh, so you could have all of our football players then.
Right.
You just send them over there.
Yeah, just send them over there for a season, yeah. So no Pledge of Allegiance that's commonly used, and there, no etiquette. Like the etiquette's probably taken less seriously than it is here.
Really?
Which I think's a shame, you know.
Yeah, people are pretty hardcore about it here.
Yeah. For good reason. For
right,
good reason.
Because, right. I mean, the flag is always to the flag's right.
Absolutely, yeah.
Although you don't have those kind of rules, really.
Definitely not as hardcore in Australia, but I think it's like that in the United States for good reason, because this is a great country, and the flag, for one, deserves to be respected.
Yeah. It's just funny you think it happened. I mean, I don't know. In the back of my mind, I guess I forget that everywhere doesn't do that.
Right.
You know,
so, yeah, I mean, if you're...
I assume we're all doing the same thing.
If you're attending a cricket game in Australia, then you would stand out if you were to do something like put your hand in your heart. Oh, it must be an American tourist watching a game of cricket.
Oh, you know? No kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
How big an influence does Britain have with Australia?
It has vast influence. I mean, Australia only federated from the United Kingdom in 1901. And I think... Again, don't quote me on it because I'm not a historian, but I think that Australians may have been using British passports until maybe the 1960s. Mm. It's, you know, as the United States obviously has a lot of ties to the United Kingdom historically, and so does Australia. But with Australia, one, it's more recent, and two, there was no War of Independence.
Right.
So, there's definitely a more immediate tie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that whole, when you have to fight him to get rid of him, that kind of entrenches everyone a little bit more.
That's right. That's
right. A whole different attitude about the whole thing.
Yeah. And also time. And I would say, if you look at it today in 2018, I'd say America and the United Kingdom probably have roughly equal influence on Australia.
Oh,
because,
wow.
Because, culturally, politically, economically, both countries have probably about an equal influence, and I think America gained influence really following World War II, or during World War II,
mm-hmm.
Because of assisting Australia with the Japanese threat, and then the economic trade between the two countries.
Sure.
Following that.
What do you, since you've been here for this, several year period, when you look around, what are... Like, things have really polarized. When you first got here,
right in the heat of the
politics
Trump
were kind
campaign.
Of mm-hmm. kind of one way, and then all of a sudden, the beginning of 2017 was like, we were off to the races in sort of a strange way. What do you think the biggest misconception people, Americans, have about their own country? Just from looking in from the...
In a nutshell, I think especially a lot of older Americans that have more experience and have seen things, how they were in the past more. Uh-huh. They a lot of Americans seem to have this notion that, America's going to hell in a handbasket, we're doomed, the naysayers. And I think that is the most patently false thing someone could possibly say. This country's got its challenges right now that America's facing politically and internally and externally challenges, right? But it's nothing insurmountable. It's nothing bigger than what America's faced in the past, both internally and externally.
So it isn't like, ooh, good thing I got there when I did because it'll be gone.
Oh, no. I mean, look, say externally, United States faced Nazi Germany and Soviet Union all in one century. Internally, you had the women's rights movement. You had the civil rights movement. All of that. You had the '60s. You had Vietnam. You had So America's been through a lot, and it's a hard country. And
we're still here.
Yeah,
yeah. And I think that's a really good point. Is Americans. With all their differences, and especially now, as polarized as we are right now, it doesn't take very much for everybody to just flip the switch and come back together again.
Mm.
I mean, you look at what
9/11
happened.
9/11 was a great example of that.
A great example.
Absolutely.
It doesn't ever take a whole lot. Well, maybe it does take a whole lot, but it's still there. There's still that American spirit that can be awakened at any moment with any great event. I think people would come together on a lot of fronts.
And I think for every one thing that you can point out to me that's going wrong in American culture and American politics right now, I can tell you 10 things that are going right,
mm-hmm.
that maybe weren't going right in the past. So there's a lot to be hopeful for, and I'm very optimistic for the future of this country.
Oh, I am too. I think there's a lot of things on the horizon that maybe weren't there, just not.
And I just keep hearing,
too far off.
When you told me, people are much more conservative here than they are in other places, and it that's just so funny because we really do. Mm. I mean,
it's just
those of us that are here all the time. Right. We look at it and it's like, oh, for God's sake! Right. I mean, what are we doing?
At the end of the day, America is based on individual liberty, capitalism, free enterprise. And that's always going to be, I think, at the root of American politics. So that's why I think even, someone who might consider themselves center-left over here, whether they're going to admit it or not, they probably have more conservative beliefs than someone who would consider themselves center-left in a Western European country.
Mm-hmm.
Probably. So. Yeah. And tell me this. Do people get involved, like, if you go back home and you want to be involved in politics, is it like here, that's kind of weird, but, I mean, are is it like here where really very few people are involved in politics?
I mean, politicians are hated around the world for good reason, right? So
you do have some similarities.
Exactly. And I think that's probably the same everywhere for the most part.
So you have 95% of the people popping off on various topics, but just a handful that work.
Of course. And that's like that at every level. And that's the same overseas. Yeah. The actual active part of society is much smaller than
kind of the
society
same deal
at large. Yeah.
Interesting. And do you have a political? Will you go back to school over there? Like, will you do political science there?
I would like to go get, say, my bachelor's degree as a minimum. But right now, I'm career orientated, so I'm going to let that take a backseat and figure out what the next chapter of my career is. And then once I've got that, locked down, then I'll consider going back to school, maybe online, so I can work and do say.
Well, that makes
my
sense.
Bachelor's degree online.
Well, working in American politics. For the time you spent over here, will that help you over there? Will that influence?
I'm confident it will.
Yeah.
I worked in state politics in California. And it's the fifth largest economy in the world. It's a huge state, and therefore state government. It's a big deal. And mm-hmm. I think I'm 100% convinced that it will definitely empower me with experience.
Sure.
Whether or not people will want that or not is another question, but I'm confident.
Yeah, whether it's marketable or not.
Yeah, whether or not it's marketable, that's a different question. But will it actually give me the tools and the experience needed over there? Absolutely.
Right.
How I market that's I'll have to figure that out.
So did when you were in high school, working at Starbucks, thinking I'm gonna save my money, I'm gonna go to America, work in politics, and people were like, sure you are.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So when you left, were they like, yeah, good luck with that?
Yeah, exactly.
And then you heard, he's what?
So you get to go back with a whole backpack full of I told you so, huh?
Exactly. And great relationships that I've been able to build over here with people like you
folks. You've done great work here. I mean, I, as far as we knew, you were a great American citizen. So good on you for your keen disguise.
Thank you.
And it was a complete.
It's really been an honor and a pleasure to be in Northern California, to be in the U.S. And
well, another good thing too is when you go home now, you'll at least have an archive of your experience on one of the top radio shows.
Exactly,
one of the top radio shows in the North State. Yeah,
I'll put on my resume extensive experience in talkback radio.
There you go,
broadcasting.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh,
well, thanks
gosh.
For being with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for inviting
me on.
It's
a lot. I didn't want you to escape the country without coming in. I just thought your message is something that people should hear.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. About Mexico all the time. That's the only immigration we ever discuss, and all the people breaking the rules. So thanks for coming here and not breaking the rules, and
thank you for having me.
Being a great job,
you
doing
bet.
A great job. Our guest has been Simon Watson this hour. You can find out about him, and I think we're going to list some contact info for him. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.